I'm continually amazed at the talented people that God brings to us. And it's fun. It's fun to be with you guys and to work with you. Keep on. Keep on. Let's keep moving. In our sermon series, we're still in the Gospel of Luke, chapter 6. It's been popular in the last few years in Christian circles to talk about living counterculturally, against the culture, or different than the culture. And that's true. And true Christian living is counter to the values of the world. But that's not a new situation. It's sometimes I liken it to the fascination these days of living off-grid. You know, that's a popular thing to do. And we act as if we found a some new way to live simply. But really, that's kind of back to the old ways, isn't it? And by the way, it fascinates me that those who are making money off living off the grid, have cameras and all to and all the stuff to publish what they're doing. That's not quite off the grid, is it? But anyway, our topic today is living counterculturally, downside up. Real disciples of Jesus do not pursue the same things as the world. Following Jesus may cause us to be poorer, hungry, without popular friends. But we're promised joy and eternal rewards. And honestly, not everybody is willing to go this way. Most are attracted to immediate satisfaction, wealth, comfort, and fame. And Jesus must have been right when he told his disciples that they if they live differently than the world will not accept them. The world will not like them. They will say bad things about them. He must have been right because the world still does not do things Jesus' way. We still have not, as a society, we have not adopted Jesus' ways. His teaching is still countercultural. And as a matter of keeping up with Luke's presentation here of who Jesus is and what Jesus taught, we'll pick up where we left off last week in chapter 6, and we're going to pick up with verse 12 today. And this first section that we're going to read describes Jesus calling 12 of the disciples to be designated as apostles. So Luke chapter 6 and verse 12. One of those days, Jesus went up to a mountainside to pray, and he spent the night praying to God. When morning came, he called his disciples to him and chose 12 of them, who he also designated as apostles: Simon, whom he called Peter, his brother Andrew, James, John, Philip, Bartholomew, Matthew, Thomas, James, son of Alphaeus, Simon, who was called the Zealot, Judas, son of James, and Judas Iscariot, who would become a traitor. Pausing there for a moment, we find the group in Galilee, somewhere near Capernaum, obviously in the hills outside of Capernaum, up on a mountain. And before we get to the 12, please notice what Jesus did the night before he announced the 12. It says he spent all night in prayer to God. Apparently went off by himself and prayed all night long. And I found myself wondering, what was that conversation like? God the Son and God the Father spending all night together talking over the future of the movement. Is this the right time to choose some leaders? Is this the right place to announce it? Which ones, Father, should I choose? There's a lot of good people here. Apparently, Jesus heard from the Father, or they agreed, and when morning came, he called all of his disciples together and chose out of the group that was there, however many that was, he chose 12, and he didn't do it secretly. He called them right out of the group. He designated them to be apostles. We get that word directly from the Greek. Apostle. Apostolos, apostolou, the ending depends on the tense of the word. But apostles, what does that mean to us? It refers to someone being sent out. Specifically sent out representing someone else. We often call that an ambassador. The United States sends out ambassadors to the world to represent our interests. And so Jesus has called these out to represent him and go forth with his project, with his kingdom. Out of all the people who had decided to follow him and had made some level of commitment, he chose these 12. To become the leaders of the church movement on his behalf. And of course, there are expectations of all followers of Jesus, as there were then. But much more was required of these 12. They were given higher responsibility. They were given extraordinary power and authority to accomplish what they were being sent to do. One commentary noted that they were mostly Galilean. In fact, maybe all of them were Galilean except Judas Iscariot. And he reckoned that because being called Iscariot means he was from a town further south in Judea. And I'm not sure what to make of that they were mostly Galilean, except that it occurred to me he did not go to the religious headquarters to recruit his team. He called fishermen, business people, a tax collector, a zealot. That means nationalist, patriot, willing to use violence to cause a disturbance. And he chose one he knew would be a traitor and told them all, come. I have work for you. Let's move on. In verse 17, Jesus went down with them and stood on a level place. A large crowd of his disciples was there, and a great number of people from all over Judea, from Jerusalem and from the coastal region around Tyre and Sidon, who had come to hear him and be healed of their diseases. Those troubled by impure spirits were cured. And the people all tried to touch him because power was coming from him and healing them all. Looking at his disciples, Jesus said, blessed are you who are poor, for yours is the kingdom of God. Blessed are you who hunger now, for you will be satisfied. Blessed are you who weep now, for you will laugh. Blessed are you when people hate you, when they exclude you and insult you and reject your name as evil because of the Son of Man. Rejoice in that day and leap for joy, because great is your reward in heaven. That is how their ancestors treated the prophets. But woe to you who are rich, for you have already received your comfort. Woe to you who are well fed now, for you will go hungry. Woe to you who laugh now, for you will mourn and weep. Woe to you when everyone speaks well of you, for that is how their ancestors treated the false prophets. Scholars like to debate whether this sermon on the plain, so to speak, the sermon on the level place, was the same as Matthew's Sermon on the Mount. There are a lot of similarities. There's also some differences in how they're presented. So was this the same sermon and the same event, just described by two different men years later? Or were they different events? I'm convinced that Jesus retaught these things as he went. So it really makes no difference if it's the same event or not, but you have to wonder. When you read Matthew 5 through 7 and you read Luke 6, you see that there are a lot of similarities, but there's some real differences too. And the best advice I read on this was just pick one and move on with it. You're not going to get it right either way. You don't know for sure. Just pick one and move on and see what Jesus was teaching and see how Luke presents it and what he's trying to get us to see. So that's what we're going to try to do this morning. On level ground, a plain. And Luke gives us some insight into the group that was there. He says a large crowd of disciples were there. Those were people who had some level of commitment to following Jesus already. They wanted to hear his teaching. They did want to see the healing and to be healed, but they were interested in what he taught and had given up something already to follow him. And of course, the 12 were there. But there was also a great number of people from all over, from Judea, even all the way down to Jerusalem, and as far west as the coastal towns of Tyre and Sidon. That's a pretty large region, especially if your transportation is your feet. I think we literally can say people were coming from everywhere to hear what Jesus taught and to be healed. Notice that people were healed of diseases and freed from impure spirits. People were trying to touch Jesus because power was coming from him and healing them all. That's a pretty unique description. Power was coming from him and people were healed apparently just by touching him. This was a big event. Involved a wide range of people, a wide range of commitment, a wide range of interest in what he was doing. I think we could surmise that there were some who were there for the show, for the entertainment. There were some there because they desperately wanted healing. And there were some who said, this may be the Messiah. We're going to follow along and see where this leads. And notice the sentence, verse 20. It's the beginning of verse 20. Looking at the disciples, he said. So when he began to speak this sermon, and we've only read the introduction to it, he was looking at his disciples. He was focusing his attention on those who had already made some commitment to follow him. He's talking directly to the people who had given up things to follow him and we might say already had some skin in the game. And I think it just helps us to understand these beatitudes and woes if we think about to whom he was focusing. And one commentary even called this the preamble to the sermon. It's the introduction. It's designed to grab attention, and I'm sure it would if you were on a hillside and Jesus started saying, you're blessed if you're poor. You're blessed if you're hungry. You're blessed if people don't like you on account of my name. He's turning the world's expectations downside up. What would be the downside, he's turning heavenly, heavenward bound. It's good to be poor and hungry and disliked. It certainly would have been attention getting. It sets the tone, but we're not even to the body of the message yet. It challenges our thinking. Just think about those committed followers as we go back through those beatitudes and woes. Blessed are you who are poor, for yours is the kingdom of God. Blessed are you who hunger now, for you will be satisfied. Blessed are you who weep now, for you will laugh. Blessed are you when people hate you, when they exclude you and insult you and reject your name as evil because of the Son of Man. Rejoice in that day and leap for joy, because great is your reward in heaven. For that is how their ancestors treated the prophets. You see, their ancestors had rejected the true prophets of God because they didn't like the message. Their message was often harsh, and they preached judgment, and they were trying to call back people back to God, and they were rejected. And then the next set, woe here, I don't think is a curse. I think it's a warning. Careful now, he says. Woe to you who are rich, for you've already received your comfort. Woe to you who are well fed now, for you will go hungry. Woe to you who laugh now, for you will mourn and weep. Woe to you when everyone speaks well of you, for that is how their ancestors treated the false prophets, the ear ticklers, those who say what you want to hear to make you feel good. They were accepted well. I think it's helpful to consider this as a whole, or maybe two sections, rather than infinitely trying to dissect each statement. These are not prescriptions. It does not say, make sure you go and be poor. Now, you would expect an American preacher to say that, right? Because we like our wealth. I mean, compared to those people and compared to the population of the world today, all of us are rich. So no point in looking around to see who's richer than you. We all fit the category of the wealthy here. Doesn't say go and try to be poor. It doesn't say make sure people reject you. It describes what had already happened and what would happen if people seriously follow Jesus and obey Jesus. Just think of these among the 12. Peter and Andrew, James and John walked away from their fishing business. It says literally they left their nets and walked away to follow Jesus. Matthew walked away from a very lucrative toll booth. Simon the Zealot must have had to change his ways drastically. Like I said, a nationalist, we might call him a patriot. The Zealots were a political group and zealous for Israel, and they were very willing to take on Rome, and they didn't mind using a sword or a knife to get it done, cause protest or whatever they needed to do to upset Rome's efforts. Simon's just the kind of guy, Simon the Zealot's just the kind of guy who in his previous life might have assassinated Matthew the tax collector and be held a hero among his peers. And now they're on the same team. had to give up his old ways. If I would dare to paraphrase some of this, and I absolutely understand the danger of that, but if I would dare, it would be something like this. Jesus said, if you keep following me and living my way, you will know what it's like to be poor. You will know hunger. You will experience sorrow, and people are going to reject you and say terrible things about you, and you'll be plumb happy. You will know joy in the midst of it all. You will have eternal rewards in my kingdom. By the way, we haven't yet read all about the eternal rewards, but take note, Jesus wasn't just being polite or tossing out an encouraging statement there. He meant it. You are going to have some hard times. You will love it, and you will be blessed beyond what this world offers you. You can know the peace that goes beyond our understanding. Leap for joy, he said. On the other hand, if you value your wealth and your things more than living my way, well, you might as well go ahead and enjoy it now. It won't last. It's not eternal. If you'd rather be comfortable and well-fed than go on this adventure with me, well, go on. If you're just in it for the fun, better enjoy it. It will fade out quickly. And be careful about believing all the nice praise people give you. Their ancestors said the same thing about false prophets, and those false prophets have no tenure in my kingdom. By worldly standards, this life may look like poverty and mistreatment, but when you experience my freedom, you will be glad you made the trade. You'll be happy and blessed. Jesus flipped the model. His economy is different than the world's economy. And by the way, you've probably figured out by now, at least those of you with gray hair, when we accumulate a lot of things, our things start to own us. Have you noticed? Our things start to own us, and our lives become controlled by the stuff. My wife came to me yesterday, heavy-hearted, and what are we going to do with all this junk we're hoarding? Nobody wants it anyway. You know? And we've only been back stateside 9 years. From when we left everything, and we're already overflowing with stuff again. We'll try to do something about that. Build bigger silos, is that right? Oh, that's the problem with this sermon. It gets in my business. I don't know how you can read it and not start asking questions. And remember, Jesus was not saying to make sure that you live below the poverty line and that you go without adequate medicine or shelter. He didn't say, go make sure people hate you. Sometimes Christians act like that. We're trying to make the world hate us. That's not what he said. But let me tell you, if you need to sell your things and give to the poor in order to follow Jesus, then do it. If you have to do that to get out of the captivity of wealth, then do it. He did say to a rich young man one day who was searching for God's kingdom, yeah, you've got the rules down, but your stuff's keeping you from me. So go and sell everything you have and give to the poor. And the man went away sorrowfully. It's hard. Some of us will have to give up our political clout and learn a different kind of influence. Now, I didn't say go make people angry, but there are times when we just know we can't go that way, even if it will give us more clout, more pull. Remember, this is just the introduction to the sermon. We haven't got to the hard part yet. This part is designed to get our attention and to challenge our thinking, and I think it really does. But the hard part comes next. Look, if you have subtitles in your book, look at what the next one is. Love your enemies. It begins to get prescriptive. It begins to say, go do this. Love your enemies. Do good for those who hate you. But we're not going to go there today. We'll hold on to that for next week. You know, Jesus made some really challenging statements, and he made them in a wide variety of settings and times. At one point, he's quoted to have said, come to me, all you who are weary and burdened, and I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon me and learn from me, for I am gentle and humble in heart. You will find rest for your weary souls. Doesn't that sounds comforting? And then another time he said, if you want to be my disciple, you have to deny yourself every day and follow me. Take up your cross daily. A cross is death. You have to die to yourself daily. Those two things might seem inconsistent. On the one hand, Jesus saying, I know you're carrying heavy burdens. Come to me, I'll give you rest. And on the other side, he's saying, deny yourself. Are those consistent? How can those claims be consistent from the same Lord? How can we live like this, like he's beginning to describe? Come and see. Come and see. Come along. Come along the journey. Read the stories. Begin to take some steps toward the ways of Jesus. And see for yourself. What did he promise? Happiness, joy, eternal rewards. That's the good stuff. Let's pray.